welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. The month of May is just ahead, and before we start looking at this summer's crops of light, airy beach reads, I wanted to preview some fabulous new histories that are working their way up the bestseller lists. From World War I Germany and the Far East, to 19th century Vienna, to the colonial Caribbean, this week we'll sample titles brimming with satisfying substance. My guest today, Les Standiford, stops by to introduce us to Water to the Angels. If you've ever visited L.A., you'll be fascinated by this history of a man and the series of events so integral to the growth of the city. Get ready to discover the true stories behind historical events we thought we knew as we turn to page one of the book report. Dead Wake is Eric Larson's highly anticipated history of the sinking of the Lusitania, published to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the disaster. On May 1, 1915, a luxury ocean liner as richly appointed as an English country house sailed out of New York, bound for Liverpool, carrying a record number of children and infants. The passengers were anxious. Germany had declared the seas around Britain to be a war zone. For months, its U-boats had brought terror to the North Atlantic. But the Lusitania was one of the era's greatest transatlantic greyhounds, and her captain, William Thomas Turner, placed tremendous faith in the gentlemanly strictures of a warfare that for a century had kept civilian ships safe from attack. He knew that his ship, the fastest then in service, could outrun any threat. But Germany and Captain Walter Schweiger of Unterseeboot 20 were about to change the rules. As U-boat 20 and the Lusitania made their ways toward Liverpool, an array of forces, both grand and small, a chance fog, a closely guarded secret, and more, converged to produce one of the great disasters of history. Scott Brick narrates the story of the hunter and the hunted while painting a larger portrait of America at the height of the Progressive Era.
A stickler for detail and discipline, Captain Turner called himself an old-fashioned sailorman. He had been born in 1856, in the age of sail and empire. His father had been a sea captain, but had hoped his son would choose a different path and enter the church. Turner refused to become a devil dodger, his term, and at the age of 8 somehow managed to win his parents' permission to go to sea. He wanted adventure and found it in abundance. He first served as a cabin boy on a sailing ship, the Grasmere, which ran aground off Northern Ireland on a clear moonlit night. Turner swam for shore. All the other crew and all passengers aboard were rescued, though one infant died of bronchitis. Had it been stormy, one passenger wrote, I believe not a soul could have been saved. Turner moved from ship to ship and at one point sailed under his father's command aboard a square rigger. I was the quickest man aloft in a sailing ship, Turner said. His adventures continued. While he was second mate of a clipper ship, the Thunderbolt, a wave knocked him into the sea. He had been fishing at the time. A fellow crewman saw him fall and threw him a life buoy, but he floated for over an hour among circling sharks before the ship could fight its way back to his position. He joined Cunard on October 4, 1877, at a salary of £5 per month, and 2 weeks later sailed as third officer of the Cherbourg, his first steamship. He again proved himself a sailor of more than usual bravery and agility. One day, in heavy fog, as the Cherbourg was leaving Liverpool, the ship struck a small bark, which began to sink. 4 crew and a harbor pilot drowned. The Cherbourg dispatched a rescue party, which included Turner, who himself pulled a crewman and a boy from the rigging. Turner served as third officer on 2 other Cunard ships, but resigned on June 28, 1880, after learning that the company never promoted a man to captain unless he'd been master of a ship before joining the company. Turner built his credentials, earned his master's certificate, and became captain of a clipper ship, and along the way found yet another opportunity to demonstrate his courage. In February 1883, a boy of 14 fell from a dock into Liverpool Harbor, into water so cold it could kill a man in minutes. Turner was a strong swimmer, at a time when most sailors still held the belief that there was no point in knowing how to swim, since it would only prolong your suffering. Turner leapt in and rescued the boy. The Liverpool Shipwreck and Humane Society gave him a silver medal for heroism. That same year, he rejoined Cunard and married a cousin, Alice Hitching. They had two sons, the first, Percy, in 1885, and Norman 8 years later. Even now, as a certified ship's master, Turner's advance within Cunard took time. The delay, according to his best and longtime friend George Ball, caused him great frustration. But, Ball added, never at any time did he relax in devotion to duty, nor waver in the loyalty he always bore to his ship and his captain. Over the next 2 decades, Turner worked his way upward from third officer to chief officer, through 18 different postings, until on March 19th, 1903, Cunard at last awarded him his own command. He became master of a small steamship, the Aleppo, which served Mediterranean ports.
We've just heard Dead Wake by Eric Larson. Les Standiford is a historian and author. Since 1985, Les has been a professor of English at Florida International University and director of their creative writing program. You may know Les from his popular John Deal crime novels, but today we'll speak with Les about his newest history, Water to the Angels, William Mulholland, his monumental aqueduct, and the rise of Los Angeles. Les attended the Air Force Academy, Columbia University School of Law, and he holds a BA in psychology and an MA and PhD in literature and creative writing. Les spent 20 years in the West, working at times for the U.S. Forestry Department, the Utah Parks Company, and the U.S. Park Service. He is a former screenwriting fellow and graduate of the American Film Institute in L.A. Among his many awards are the Frank O'Connor Award for Short Fiction and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction. Welcome, Les. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Book Report.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
What drew you to the story of William Mulholland?
I went to California when I was a kid and stood up on Mulholland Drive one night and looked out over the sprawl of lights to the north and to the south, and I said, how on earth did a place like this ever come to be? And never really thought I would write a book about it, but that question stayed with me for a long time. I was a kid from the sticks in Ohio, and I never got over that initial amazement. I've always been drawn to a story that people might think they know a little about, but that my research suggests to me that they don't know the whole story there. And that's Mulholland's story is one of those, particularly, I think, owing to the great success of that classic movie, Chinatown, which uses some of the background of the California water wars, and yet it's a fictional story. It plays fast and loose with the facts. And I ran across a chance comment by Robert Towne saying, you know, the real story behind Chinatown is just as good as the fictional one that we made up. I wish I could have told it. And that comment stuck with me, and my fascination with California and that comment of Towns led me to do some research, and that's what's really resulted in this book.
Mulholland was not a formerly trained engineer, and he readily admitted, I learned the 3 R's and the 10 Commandments, received my father's blessing, and here I am. So how did he ascend to be the chief of LA's water department?
Hard work, honesty, competence, vision, I think, more than anything. And he loved the place. He, early on, went to work for what was a private company. The Los Angeles Water Company was a private concern, and he worked for the individuals who owned it. Always complained that they diverted more money to dividends than to infrastructure, this system Mulholland did. And got a job as a ditch digger in 1877, shortly after he'd come to Los Angeles when there were about 9,000 people there, if you can imagine. William Mulholland in life was a contemporary, to place him in context, was a contemporary of Wyatt Earp. How far back we're going. And he only outlived Earp by, I think, 5 or 6 years. Anyway, he went to work for the water company as a ditch digger, worked himself up, became superintendent of that company by the late 1880s. And then about 15 years after that, the city finally decided that it needed to be in control of its own water supply, bought the private water company, and brought William Mulholland along with it, because he was acknowledged as the man who knew everything there was to know about water in that very dry part of the country.
So tell us about Mulholland and his role in the creation of the aqueduct.
There was a former mayor of Los Angeles named Fred Eaton, who'd been floating the idea to take a river that he had run across in north central California on the east side of the Sierras, the Owens, in the Owens Valley, to bring it down around Death Valley, is where Eaton really saw his community centered. And when water became a real issue in L.A. in the late 90s, Eaton was boosting this plan to tap this river to anyone who would listen, but nobody really took him seriously. Nobody thought it could be possible. Finally, when things got to a crisis stage, Mulholland went to Eaton and said, "Show me this water you've been talking about for the past decade." And they took a legendary buckboard trip. It said that you could follow their trail by the glint of the whiskey bottles from their buckboard into the moonlight. And Mulholland saw this river and 250 miles, stood on its bank about 250 miles away from downtown LA after riding 4 days up there, and said, "You know, Fred, I think this can be done." And with a pocket compass and an aneroid barometer, he laid out in the next couple of months the line, engineered the line that would take a river from the Owens Valley of California and take it 233 miles to Los Angeles. They had to sell the idea to the voters and raise the money to actually do a thing that most people said was impossible at the outset. But that's what he set himself to do.
And how long did the project take?
Construction began in 1907, and it was completed in 1913. The water actually reached the San Fernando Valley. Now, it took a little while to connect the pipes so that the first glass of water that was enjoyed by a Los Angeles citizen that had come from the Owens Valley wasn't tasted out of a tap, other than for ceremonial
purposes. We're speaking with Les Standiford on the Book Report. Looking ahead, then, can you describe the tragic dam disaster of 1928?
Mulholland, the flow of the Owens River kept Los Angeles developing. Over a million people by the 20s. But Mulholland, it had also been sabotaged over time, and there were seasonal divergences in the flow, even from the Sierra snowpack. Mulholland built a series of impoundment reservoirs to store water to guard against any future calamities. One of these was the St. Francis Dam, and built in above the Santa Clarita Valley, above Saugus and Newhall, or the pass, just over the pass from Los Angeles proper, about 35 miles away, 40 miles away. And one night, 2 years after that dam was completed, it gave way. The resulting flood washed all the way to 60 miles all the way to the Pacific Ocean, washing out bridges and roads, everything in its path, and killing about 600 people. It's the worst civil engineering disaster in California history, and second only to the San Francisco earthquake and flood in the magnitude and lives lost and damage. And Mulholland was not only personally devastated, he was 73 at that, almost 73 at the time. Also, it meant the end of his career because he'd personally overseen the construction of that dam. Now, and the coroner's inquest, at one point he was questioned as to whether or not he thought there was human error involved, and he stopped the attorney short and said, look, if you're trying to find out if there was an individual to blame for this, then I'm the individual. Put all the blame on me. I built the dam. It was my fault. Well, the coroner's inquest finally determined that it was no one's fault, that no one could have prevented the disaster, and that he was not responsible.
Les, this book was so rich in detail. How long did you work on it before you even started putting pen to paper?
Two and a half years, I'd say.
You know, as you're the head of the creative writing program, what advice would you give someone who wants to write a book about a historical figure?
Well, given the effort that's involved, you need to make sure that it's a historical figure that you think merits all the time and trouble. The fact is that many of the subjects I've written about, Carnegie, for instance, have had doorstopper biography as written about them, 1,000-page tomes, when there were a couple of them in existence when I wrote Meet You in Hell. I had focused in on one part, what I thought was an essential part of Carnegie's career and his relationship with Henry Clay Frick and the Homestead Steel Strike of 1892, because I thought that individual episode of his life had never been given proper treatment. In the same way, I feel that Mulholland's achievement and effort has been overshadowed by contemporary, there have been a number of books focusing on contemporary water politics, but because they're concerned more with what should have happened than what did happen. And I wanted to hark back to a time when a person like Mulholland could conceive of an impossible project and bring it in, not only on time, but under budget. That's quite an example to view in our day and age.
Any final thoughts on Mulholland?
If he were alive today, I would ask him one question. It's, Mr. Mulholland, we're running out of water in California again. What do you think we should do?
Les, thank you so much for joining me today. I have to say, I love the book, Water to the Angels. It makes it all come alive. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's listen to a sample of Water to the Angels, performed by Robert Foss.
It turns out that William Mulholland was, in fact, the highest paid public official in California a century or so ago. But by today's standards, that doesn't mean much. That grand annual salary wouldn't cover the mortgage payment on most of the homes along the road bearing his name today. In 1974, Robert Towne wrote the script for Chinatown, an acclaimed film that derives substance from some of the things Mulholland was involved with, but he is called Hollis Mulray in the film. His fictional character is minor and killed early on, and the filmmakers had to fudge most of the actual facts, including the time frame, for fear audiences would get lost in the forests of history. In the latter half of the 20th century, a number of factually based works were written regarding the fierce water politics in the West, including Mark Reisner's notable Cadillac Desert, The American West and Its Disappearing Water, 1993. Mulholland and the Los Angeles Aqueduct get their fair share of mention there and in other books, including William Carl's exhaustive Water and Power, The Conflict Over Los Angeles's Water Supply in the Owens Valley, 1983, and Abraham Hoffman's Vision or Villainy, Origins of the Owens Valley-Los Angeles Water Controversy, 1981, which make the aqueduct project their primary focus. However, as some, including Catherine Mulholland, have lamented, many of the water issue books are dominated by political concerns and a seemingly unavoidable tendency to side with one group or another of the good guys du jour. I estimate that of the voluminous literature which exists concerning the history of Owens Valley and water in Southern California, Ms. Mulholland once stated, that about 50% is reliable, while the remainder, based largely on secondary and often dubious sources, could be consigned to the fiction department. Understandable, perhaps, for as the hard-bitten newspaper editor likes to observe, only trouble is interesting, and there is nothing like scandal to engage the attentions of an audience. Coupled with the temptation to judge the actions of those who lived a century ago through the lens of present-day political correctness, history often becomes subject to revision. It all became a bit too much for Ms. Mulholland, however, when she picked up an issue of the New York Times in 1991 to read an article citing Chinatown as a historical primer for understanding the practice of municipal predation upon water resources, resources to which, the Times writer maintained, the city had no right. Galled that a crime melodrama, however artful, had come to be regarded by the uninformed as a kind of documentary work on the history of Los Angeles, and dissatisfied by the paeans to Mulholland penned earlier in the century, she was moved to write William Mulholland and the Rise of Los Angeles, 2000, a biography of her grandfather that is a meticulous birth-to-death record of a remarkable life. While that publication was both well-received and thorough, in its original form it was nearly twice as lengthy, and in the editing process, certain more personal gems were unfortunately lost. In that first manuscript, Ms. Mulholland traces at some length her own history and growing fascination with her subject, including recollections of the occasional encounters with those who simply had a friendly curiosity about my relationship to the engineer, and who sometimes spoke of their admiration for your grandfather, who did so much for Los Angeles. But in time, the burden of her family's name became increasingly apparent.
That was Water to the Angels by Les Standiford. Ever since Christopher Columbus stepped off the Santa Maria onto what is today San Salvador, the Caribbean has been a stage for fantasies and competition between world powers. In Empire's Crossroads, British-American historian Carrie Gibson traces the region's story from discovery through colonialism to today. After Columbus, the British, French, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, Danish, and even the Swedes, Scots, and Germans sought their fortunes in the islands for the next two centuries. Some failed spectacularly, like the Scots in Panama. The Spaniards were the first to find prosperity. They built grandiose cathedrals and extracted shipfuls of gold and silver, which English, French, and Dutch pirates were very happy to seize. No other region of the world has experienced such a vibrant mixing of cultures, religions, and peoples. Africans, Europeans, Asians, and Amerindians created amazingly dynamic Creole societies that complicated traditional ideas about class and race. By the end of the 18th century, 70,000 free blacks and mulattoes lived in the British Islands alone, and it was in the Caribbean that the world's only successful slave revolt took place. In the 20th century, most of the islands broke from the imperial traditions, and the region experienced the explosive age of decolonization, banana republics, racial riots, and Cold War politics. Romy Nordlinga narrates.
In his 1962 Caribbean travelogue, The Middle Passage, V.S. Naipaul made the infamous claim that history is built around achievement and creation, and nothing was created in the West Indies. However, he meant it with irony, or with serious intent. This line was received with seriousness, and for some, offense. Yet in the context of the tourism industry, maybe he was right. Virgin beaches, unspoilt paradise. It is much easier to imagine a West Indies without history. Then you don't have to understand why there is poverty or inequality, but rather it is easy to think the palm trees have always swayed in the breeze and that there has always been someone to refresh your glass of rum punch. But in our post-colonial, post-modern world, such a notion seems completely anachronistic. The idea of what history is has been dissected and picked over for the past 50 years, while the study of West Indian history has come into its own, with the research now ranging from archaeology of the earliest inhabitants to musicology of 21st century dance hall. Indeed, when thinking about it, this seems the wrong way round. Everything was created in the West Indies. The Europe of today, its financial foundations built with sugar money, and the factories and mills built as a result of the work of slaves thousands of miles away. The idea of true equality as espoused in 1794 Saint Dominique, and even globalization and migration, with the ships passing to and fro, taking people and goods in all possible directions, hundreds of years before the term globalization was coined. The Caribbean contains all this. That is the basis of the Antillean experience, this shipwreck of fragments, these echoes, these shards of a huge tribal vocabulary, these partially remembered customs, and they are not decayed, but strong, Derek Walcott wrote. They survived the Middle Passage and the Fatal Razak, the ship that carried the first indentured Indians from the port of Madras to the cane fields of Felicity, that carried the chained Cromwellian convict and the Sephardic Jew, the Chinese grocer and the Lebanese merchant selling cloth samples on his bicycle.
That was Empire's Crossroads by Kerry Gibson. At midnight, December 31st, 1925, citizens of the newly proclaimed Turkish Republic celebrated the new year. For the first time, they agreed to use a nationally unified calendar and clock. Yet in Istanbul, an ancient crossroads and Turkey's largest city, people were looking forward to an uncertain future. In Midnight at the Pera Palace, Charles King describes Istanbul as home to generations of Greeks, Armenians, and Jews, Muslims, plus white Russian nobles ousted by the Russian Revolution, Bolshevik assassins, German professors, British diplomats, and American entrepreneurs. During the Second World War, thousands of Jews fleeing occupied Europe found passage through Istanbul, some with the help of the future Pope John XXIII. At the Pera Palace, Istanbul's most luxurious hotel, so many spies mingled in the lobby, the manager posted a sign asking them to relinquish their seats to paying guests. Narrator Grover Gardner brings to life a remarkable era when a storied city stumbled into the modern world and reshaped the meaning of cosmopolitanism.
The old hotel was squat and square, wrapped in dirty green-plastered marble. Its faded fin de siècle grandeur was out of place amid the seedy mid-rises that had grown up pell-mell in the 1970s and 1980s. Inside, the red velvet chairs in the Orient Bar were always empty. The bartender seemed surprised whenever I stopped in for a cocktail and a bowl of stale leblebi, tooth-cracking roasted chickpeas. Things had once been different. The Pera Palace was established in 1892 to service clients arriving on the Orient Express in the capital of the Ottoman Empire. For decades afterward, it was the obvious place for out-of-towners to stay. The wood and iron elevator, which rose up like a birdcage through the marble staircase, had been only the second one installed in Europe, after the Eiffel Towers. A Baroque dining hall stood next to a lounge of faux marble inlay and filigreed screens, covered by a soaring glass canopy. Beyond the building's stately facade lay Pera, Istanbul's most fashionable neighborhood. A short walk along the main street, known to many Istanbulus in the 19th century and after as the Grand Rue, led to the embassies of most of the major world powers. Next door to the hotel, American diplomats shared the street with both the YMCA and legal brothels, and not far away, the British, Russians, and Germans could entertain government officials in gilded restaurants and dark clubs. The Pera Palace was meant to be the last whisper of the Occident on the way to the Orient, the grandest Western-style hotel in the seat of the world's greatest Islamic empire. Like Istanbul itself, the hotel was Europeans' first major port of call when they went east into a traveler's fantasy of sultans, harems, and dervishes. But before the Pera Palace had celebrated its 20th year in business, all of that had begun to change. A revolution deposed a long-reigning Ottoman sultan and ushered in more than a decade of political turmoil and communal violence. The First World War brought military defeat and foreign occupation. And in 1923, in one of modern history's most profound exercises in political self-creation, Turks made a purposeful break with their Ottoman past, rejecting an Islamic and multi-religious empire and declaring in its place a secular, more homogeneous republic. Turkey's new leaders shifted their capital 200 miles to the east, to the wind-whipped hills of Ankara, far from the corrupting memories of the old center. A young reporter named Ernest Hemingway saw the beginning. From all I had seen in the movies, Stamboul ought to have been white and glistening and sinister, he wrote in the Toronto Daily Star in the late autumn of 1922. He had arrived from the Balkans by train, rolling past brick-red Byzantine land walls and children splashing in the water, into a tumble of small mosques and wooden houses with dusty domes and sprung clapboards rubbed gray by salt and wind. He had seen roads choked with colorfully dressed peasants trudging behind muddy, bristle-haired water buffaloes. Queues of migrants in damp overcoats snaked around foreign embassies. Demobilized officers strutted in frayed tunics. From a plaza near the Pera Palace, he looked through a spyglass at refugee families pressed tight against the railings of a steamer spewing ash. Everything white was dirty white, he observed, and the mood was hopeless and resigned, like the feeling of waiting while a doctor and nurse are upstairs with someone you love. Veils and harems, fezes and frock coats were disappearing. The Sultan and the Caliphate, the institution that embodied Muslims' understanding of God's will on earth, would soon be declared defunct. Hours and dates would be reckoned the way they were in Paris or New York, not as in Mecca and Medina. Ministers and generals were moving to Ankara. Foreign embassies and their entourages would follow. Istanbul was settling into a self-absorbed sense of huzun, the hollowed-out melancholy that Turkish intellectuals said infused the crumbling walls, tumble-down mansions, and rotting seaside villas.
We've just heard Midnight at the Pera Palace by Charles King. In 1906, Huguette Clark grew up in her family's 120-room Beaux-Arts mansion in New York. She was one of the leading celebrities of her day. Her father, William Andrews Clark, was a copper magnate, the second richest man in America, and not above bribing his way into the Senate. Huguette attended the coronation of King George V. At 22, with a personal fortune of $50 million, she married a Princeton man and a childhood friend, William MacDonald Gower. 2 years later, the couple divorced. After a series of failed romances, Huguette began to withdraw from society. She became a modern-day Miss Havisham, spending her days in a vast apartment overlooking Central Park, eating crackers, and watching the Flintstones. All her money and her real estate could not protect her in her later life from being manipulated by shady hangers-on. Meryl Gordon's The Phantom of Fifth Avenue tells the story of what happened to turn a vivacious young socialite into a recluse. Bernadette Dunn performs the book.
The clerks in attendance that night included descendants of three branches of the family tree and a representative from the fourth. The senator had sired seven children during his first marriage, and then, as a widower, married a much younger woman and produced two daughters. As a result, there was a 36-year age gap between his oldest and youngest children. His grandchildren and young daughters were nearly the same age. Three children from his first marriage, the scandal-prone Manhattan divorcee Mary, known as May, the booze and racetrack-loving California bon vivant Charles, and the prim and proper Catherine, had produced seven children, and many of their descendants were in attendance this evening. Strolling past the snarling bronze lions guarding the Corcoran's entrance, Corrine Albert McCall, a petite and slender 68-year-old blonde, arrived with her husband, Donald McCall, a retired cellist. The grandchild of Charles Clark and his banking heiress wife Celia, Corrine had grown up in luxury at her grandmother's San Francisco Tudor Castle, House on Hill, a 35,000-square-foot estate on 6 acres with a 55-foot-long music room, 12 bedrooms, and lush gardens. An artist who painted colorful abstracts, the mother of three children, Corrine had spent most of the previous 40 years living in Europe, but she and her husband had just moved from London to Washington, D.C. She had recently discovered worrisome information about an elderly Clark relative and had been obsessing about what, if anything, to do. She had confided in her first cousin, Jacqueline Bayens-Clert, who had flown in from her home in Paris to attend the reunion and give Corrine moral support. Tonight, Corrine had a mission: finding allies to discuss her concerns. Corrine had never met many of her Clark relatives. As she and Donald and Jacqueline circulated through the cocktail hour at the Corcoran, introducing themselves and making small talk, there was a subtext to the conversations. As Corrine recalls, "We were trying to figure out, who can we trust?" Corrine's newfound worries centered on her great-aunt, a woman she had known all her life as Tante Huguette. The frail and moneyed Manhattan centenarian had a haunting hold on the imaginations of several generations of Clark relatives. Huguette Marcel Clark, the sole surviving child of William Andrews Clark, was now 102 years old and resided in Beth Israel Hospital in New York. No family member had seen her in 40 years. Born in 1906 in Paris to Clark's second wife, Anna, Huguette had been instantly famous for her wealth and constantly chased by photographers as a pretty child and desirable debutante, reluctantly starring in the society pages. Divorced in 1930 after a brief marriage, she never wed again or had children and cut herself off from the social whirl, deliberately cultivating an air of mystery. The gossip columnists of her era, Walter Winchell and Charlie Knickerbocker, had periodically run "whatever happened to" items about Huguette. Several third-generation Clark relatives like Corrine, now in their 60s and 70s, had met Huguette during their childhoods, but to the younger generation, she was a cipher, an eccentric curiosity. The family members speculated about her life, and several had repeatedly asked to meet her to no avail, which only made them even more curious. She haunted the imaginations of three generations of Clark relatives, an elusive, reclusive figure. "Talking with the family, none of them knew her," says Corcoran director Greenhalgh. "I'm sure they were desperate to get an audience, but none of them did." The professional photographer who had been hired to capture the reunion, Martha Fitzsimon, had been briefed about Huguette in advance, recalling, "Carla told me that nobody had been able to talk to her for years." The last time any family member could remember actually seeing Huguette was at the funeral of Carla Hall's grandmother in March 1968 at St. Thomas Church in Manhattan. "After the funeral, we all were together for a short while, greeting each other and expressing condolences," recalls Erica Hall, Carla's mother, and the widow of Huguette's great-nephew, John Hall.
That was The Phantom of Fifth Avenue by Meryl Gordon.
Jan Swofford's biographies have established him as a revered music historian. His compelling new biography, Beethoven, Anguish and Triumph, peels away layers of legend to get to the living, breathing human being who composed some of the world's most iconic music. Swofford mines new sources to reanimate the revolutionary ferment of Enlightenment-era Bonn, where Beethoven grew up and formulated the ideas that would shape his work. Swofford then tracks Beethoven to Vienna, capital of European music, where he built his career in the face of critical incomprehension, crippling ill health, romantic rejection, and fate's hammer, his ever-encroaching deafness. Michael Pritchard performs the book.
By the time he died in 1827, he was already a romantic myth, and that is what he stayed through the 19th century. Beethoven the demigod, a combination of suffering Christ figure and demonic icon. In his person, rough, crude, and fractious, in his music, everything from crude to transcendent, he became the quintessential romantic genius in an age that established a cult of genius that lingers on, for well and ill. Critical reframings and reinterpretings are inevitable, and, like everything in the arts, they reflect the temper of their times. After the lingering decay of romantic myths in the 20th century, writing on Beethoven during the past decades has largely risen from the academy. So it reflects the parade of fashions and shibboleths of that industry. Many present-day books concern ideas about Beethoven rather than Beethoven himself. The assorted theoretical postures of late 20th century academe took some heavy shots at him, but do not seem to have dislodged him from his unfortunate pedestal, which I believe lodges him too far from us. I suspect many people still feel that in some ways the most effective Beethoven biography remains the massive late 19th century one by Alexander Wheelock Thayer. That American writer set out with the goal of assembling every available fact about Beethoven and putting it down as clearly as possible. "I fight for no theories and cherish no prejudices," Thayer wrote. "My sole point of view is the truth." In the 1960s, the book was corrected and updated, with a similarly direct agenda by Elliot Forbes. For me, it is within Thayer's Victorian language that Beethoven casts the strongest shadow as a person, where I catch glimpses of him walking down the street, joking with friends, thumping the table as he composes, tearing into his fish dinner. Without aspiring to the voluminousness of Thayer, the book you are listening to was written in his spirit. Now and then, in the course of an artist's biographical history, it comes time to strip away the decades of accumulated theories and postures and look at the subject as clearly and plainly as possible, without prejudices and preconceptions. That as biographers we all have agendas, both known and unknown to us, does not change the value and necessity of getting back to the human reality of a towering figure. This book is a biography of Beethoven, the man and musician, not the myth. I want the book to stay on the ground, in his time, looking at him as directly as possible as he walks, talks, writes, rages, composes. We will see that Beethoven was, in some ways, a hard man. The troubling parts of his personality, the squalor he lived in, his growing paranoia and delusions of persecution, his misanthropy, and later his double dealings in business will be on display here roughly in the proportion that they were on display in his life. Likewise, the plaintive history of his deafness and illness and his failed love affairs. Still, I believe that in the end, there was no real meanness in Beethoven. He aspired to be a good, noble, honorable person who served humanity. At times he could be entirely lovable and delightful in his quirks and puns and metaphors and notions, even in his lusty socio-political rants. There was something exalted about him that was noted first in his teens and often thereafter. He was utterly sure of himself and his gift, but no less self-critical and without sentimentality concerning his work. To the degree that I have a conscious agenda, It is this. I am myself a composer, both before and after being a biographer. So this is a composer's eye view of a composer written for the general public. When I look at Beethoven, I see a man sitting at a table, playing the piano, walking in fields and woods, doing what I and a great many others have done, crafting music one note, one phrase, one section at a time.
We've just heard Beethoven by Jan Swofford. Readers, the novelist Alexandre Dumas remarked, "Truth is very liable to be left-handed in history." So true, but I hope you'll agree today's show has been an entertaining look at histories of fascinating events and people. For more titles to keep you turning pages, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.